Hello and welcome to the FinTech Newscast. My name's John, and this week we'll be talking about Facebook's forays into blockchain, Apple's dive into the world of finance, the benefits that small businesses are getting out of online financing, and financing going into Latin America, developing fintechs there. Please hit subscribe to keep up with this and the latest in FinTech news. All right, thanks for joining us. With me in the studio is Monica.
Hey, John.
Hey, and Steve.
Good to be here, y'all.
All right. Coming in to us from Texas, is it?
From Texas, yes, absolutely.
All right, we have a lot of great, interesting stuff going on around the world, so let's get into it. What's this little company called Facebook, did you say?
Yeah, I mean, you may have heard of it. So I wanted to share some of the latest rumors, because some of this stuff is not necessarily confirmed, that's coming out around Facebook's forays into cryptocurrency.
That's a good point, actually. You know, I've seen this all over the news, but that doesn't mean it's actual fact or anything, right?
Correct.
They're putting it together from job listings and...
Yeah, so we'll rumor monger here today, but we'll at least say that's what we're doing. So Facebook has apparently got a project codenamed Project Libra. So if you're a Libra out there, you must be happy about that. And apparently, the rumors say that Project Libra has been underway for more than a year, and its purpose is to create a digital coin that Facebook users could send to each other and use to make purchases, both on Facebook and across the internet. Apparently, Facebook is recruiting at least dozens of financial firms and other online merchants to get them on board with this vision. And the thinking here for Facebook is that, you know, cryptocurrencies are untested in lots of ways, but you've got a third of the world logging onto Facebook regularly, and all of them, however much money they make, they all buy things somewhere. What I find interesting here is that Facebook, even though they're sitting on a pile of cash, they are still looking for investors to help make this a reality. So some of the firms that at least the rumor mill says they've been talking to are firms that you'd expect. Visa, MasterCard, First Data, some of the biggest players in payments, as well as smaller firms. And those smaller firms would, of course, put up smaller stakes. But this, the goal is to get around $1 billion
and outside investment, along with what they're doing, yeah?
Correct. And that is presumably to keep the coin's value stable. If there's one thing that we have learned in talking about different cryptocurrencies, is stability is not usually their forte.
I wonder if that's they want those investments, especially from those kind of strategic partners, to kind of validate their vision as well, right?
Well, also probably to get them on board with it, because
right.
What interest does Visa and MasterCard have in Facebook cutting them out of
bypassing the rails? Yeah,
billions of dollars worth of transactions.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, so you better give them a cut of the action, because otherwise I can't really see why they'd want it.
It's also interesting because I mean, I use Venmo and PayPal, but I feel like there's Square Cash and Zelle, and everyone has a P2P solution now. Seems like it's overkill. Why would they get into this market?
Well, Facebook already has all that advertising on their site. That's such a big part of their business. If you could complete the transaction, or you get points, or through the cryptocurrency, through actions that you take, or loyalty.
But I'm sure that there's another way to enable payments within the Facebook platform, or just partnering with somebody else, like a Stripe or something, where you can do that.
Of course there is.
You don't need crypto to do this. This is not...
No.
Well, why the crypto part of it?
But right. Facebook, I think... has been very clear. If you look at Facebook, you see a dominant market player who will do pretty much anything they have to do to maintain market dominance, both in the market that they are in and any market that they want to get into.
Aren't they constrained by their ethics and conscience and a sense of right and wrong?
You must get your news from different sources. So apparently, Facebook wants to build a checkout option that other merchants can use. And the way it would work is you would be able to use your Facebook login, not just on Facebook, but on all of these other vendor sites, to be able to log in through Facebook's authentication and then access your coins from there. Doesn't that sound so nice? It doesn't to me, but Facebook probably thinks other things, and they are most likely considering some ways to reward people who use their coins to buy things, whether that's coin back instead of cash, or you could give people a discount. You know, there's lots of ways that they could do that.
It really kind of points out to me, like, once a company is putting together all the pieces, more things become possible. Like that Facebook authenticator to log in is something they offer to, I think, just about any other website. Mm-hmm. You can use Facebook to log in. I remember when I was looking at doing a website for and creating access, and Facebook login and authentication was one of the options.
Absolutely. And they have done that for a decade.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm that weird person who is like, oh, gross. No, I don't want to use my Facebook to log in here. Like, I don't want Facebook knowing I'm logging in here. And
I don't know where you're logging in, Monica, but
it doesn't matter. And no one needs to look it up. Please. Thank you. Google already knows too much. But it's definitely not for me. So as we already mentioned, it's not really clear why Visa and MasterCard would be game to go along. This is a huge threat to their business. But we'll see what they do. And y'all have already brought up the other big concern that I would have around this, which is that Facebook, if you are an active Facebook user, and even if you're not, Facebook already knows so much about you. Now it's going to know what you look at, how you respond to it, how deeply you spend time with certain things, and they're going to know everything that you spend your money on and probably have even more insights into your financial behavior. I mean, for me, that is grotesque.
I can't wait for all the convenient products and services that will result that are customized to exactly
it'll be so easy.
What I'm about.
It's worth noting that Facebook isn't the only player doing this. I think I've read that also Twitter is looking into hiring crypto or DLT developers to also have their own coin as well.
But this is where I think scale really matters. So Twitter just simply does not have the same amount of information about its users.
Yeah.
It doesn't have the same number of users. It doesn't have the same level of detail about their lives and their innermost feelings and all these other things about them that Facebook does. So while I will say I look at this and I just get grossed out all over the place, when I look at it from Facebook's perspective, you can see why this would be an incredibly potentially powerful push for them and why knowing even more detail about what every single person on Facebook is buying would be something that they would consider priceless.
Didn't also Zuckerberg key in on their privacy pivot at F8 a few weeks ago?
Right? Yes.
So maybe the crypto thing has a privacy aspect to it as well. I have no idea. But either way, it seems like an interesting play. I'm not sure that I will be part of that.
Yeah, I
feel like I already have enough ways to make payments online and offline and P2P stuff. I don't need another solution.
We're already spoilt for choice even when the transaction is just in dollars.
We certainly are, yeah.
Yeah. Well, and I think from the Facebook perspective on privacy, I mean, Facebook's eager now to keep your information within the Facebook ecosystem, right? They don't want developers to have it. They don't want hacks to happen. But they have no problem getting even more of your data, unless it would be something that might be politically too hot to handle, in which case end-to-end encryption so that you can go start your genocidal rampage without Facebook having to monitor your speech, that's fine.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Brave new world.
Something to look forward to.
Well, what kind of company is offering something with privacy, with a security that would be acceptable, that would be, you know, protective of people's
Signal.
What Signal? I don't know. Signal.
Signal.
Well, that's
Signal
not currently
sort of
a payment app, but
It's not. But it's the same. It's basically like a WhatsApp, but it's not owned by Facebook, and it's better encrypted, I think.
So it was actually founded by one of the WhatsApp founders who left Facebook, and then
Facebook. I can't do this now. So it's more cryptographically secure.
But it's just a messaging app?
It's just messaging, but okay. It makes sense if you're on the platform as well, and if you want to deal in Bitcoin or other cryptocurrencies to kind of deploy it in that ecosystem.
On my VPN, using my Tor browser, and then I use Signal.
All
and
of
I have
that.
Some reasonable expectation that at least it's not super easy to...
And I would also say, to answer your question, John, you know, if you really want to keep your transaction private, try cash.
Well, you're buying stuff online. I mean, it's not near you or...
Yeah, but you don't have to buy everything online.
Yeah, well, Facebook's not the only one getting into finance. I mean, everybody sees all the money in here, and we can see all the VC money going into this, but all the big players are jumping in, right?
From one tech giant to the other, yeah. So I'd like to take a few minutes here to discuss why Apple is getting into financial services, what their strategy is, and what they hope to get out of this. So a few things to point out. There are actually 90 million people in the U.S. who've used iPhones. I happen to have both an iPhone and an Android. But,
ooh,
you know,
la la.
Show
ooh,
off.
La la. I know. Yeah, well, one's for work. But typically, iPhone users have a higher socioeconomic status than Android users, right? They spend more money on apps. They are wealthier.
iPhones are more expensive.
They're more expensive as
the
well.
The average price of an iPhone is more expensive than the average price of an Android.
Right, right. It's also, it's a way to kind of broadcast your status as well. Like, I have an Android that cost me like $170. But you can also...
Well, that's about right for your status.
That's about right for my status, yeah. It fits me, yeah, yeah. Or you could have an iPhone 10X or whatever and be like, I'm a baller. I spend $1,000 on a phone, which is stupid, but that's what people do.
I guess he's just trying to make me feel bad about my XR.
But Apple has taken steps to get into the space in two ways. They announced a few months ago, the Apple Card, which is this Goldman Sachs-backed thing where you can have a virtual card on your phone. You can make physical purchases with Apple Pay at the terminal. It'll be fairly secure. The card won't have any account numbers on it and all that stuff. And the card offers you a number of rewards, like 2% cash back on random purchases and 3% on Apple stuff, which, by the way, is not that good of a deal. You can get a higher cash back numbers than what you get from Apple. But it's all within the Apple system. And then the Apple Card will, of course, give you access to the Clarity Money-backed PFM that they will have, hopefully, in the next release.
And PFM means?
Personal Finance Management. So think of it as like a Mint.com, but for 2019. So they've expanded it.
Real slam on Mint.
I haven't used Mint in like 10 years.
Is Mint still around?
Yeah,
it's still about around. It like yeah. It's like from the 70s or something.
Yeah, it's around.
Yeah, it's owned by Intuit.
The same owners as QuickBooks and other.
So everybody says they want to be like Mint. Why hasn't Mint become something else? Or the
I think Mint
the whole world?
Mint was a good stab at this, and it was sort of the first mass market product that really popularized the idea of having all your stuff in one place and help you see where your money's going and all that kind of stuff. And then people just released a bunch of other things that kind of competed with that. So there's Clarity Money, there's Minna, there's a whole bunch of other PFMs that you can use. So they kind of became popular, but then not as cutting edge. And
are innovative. They the MySpace of the PFM
They're
world?
The MySpace, exactly. Great analogy. They're the MySpace of the PFM world.
And monetizing that business model isn't necessarily the easiest thing either. You know, there's only so many credit cards that people are going to click through and get, and you know,
where
your affiliate.
Where did they develop their services more and grow that?
Well, if
base.
I recall correctly, I do think that Mint has been trying to do that, and they, you know, it's owned by Intuit, so Intuit already has QuickBooks, as mentioned, which a lot of small businesses own, a lot of small businesses use, mm-hmm. and so I think Mint was trying to look at ways to kind of tap into different types of personal loans and small business loans potentially. But
right.
I don't know how far along they are on that.
Probably not that far. It's also worth noting that Apple as a company, even though they hit the $1 trillion mark, you've seen it's kind of a slowdown in iPhone sales and in hardware. So they're really getting into the more of the services part of that. And I think the Apple Card would also enable them to get into that space a little more strongly than you would otherwise. So this card would allow them to cut out the interchange fees they pay to the banks, to the issuing banks, the acquiring banks, the payment rails, and all that kind of stuff. They will also be able to, if you get paid into your Apple Pay, you will then have a balance likely, and Apple can play with that balance as well, which is what a lot of the other players do, like Square and Venmo.
Mm-hmm.
And finally, they're able to kind of create a closed loop system, kind of bring you into the Apple walled garden so that it's all more secure. And again, you kind of stay in there and, you know, they cut out a lot of the other players that would dip into that and get some fees from that and just extract as much revenue as they can from every iPhone user.
So as they try to extract as much revenue as they can I mean, do you see the next step as them offering loans, which Marcus does, the Goldman, their
that's,
Goldman partner?
That's a very, very good point. I was surprised
and then offering checking and savings. Is this like the Trojan horse for Apple?
It may be. I mean, it seems like Goldman? So it's interesting because a lot of newer players have checking accounts. Even T-Mobile has one, right? As we discussed, Robinhood has a quasi checking account. Same with Wealthfront. So anyway, a lot of players are offering cash management accounts now. So yeah, it would make sense in a future, you know, in a year or so from now, once this is more developed, for them to make this into a more, you get your credit card, you get your checking account, your P2P payments, you can pay for stuff online through Safari, and have it all within the Apple ecosystem.
So your kids will live in the Apple apartment complex, drive their Apple car. No, they won't drive. They'll take a ride.
It'll be a driverless Apple car. Yeah,
going
yeah.
to their Apple store where they'll stock the shelves.
Right.
So this Apple Card is a little newer, but Apple Pay has been around for a while. What do we know about how that's been going?
Yeah, so interestingly enough, I read somewhere that 43% of iPhone users have enabled Apple Pay. I've never used a mobile wallet to pay for anything in my life.
I wanted to ask
yeah,
how the three
never
of us have done.
I don't use, I never used Samsung Pay when I had a Samsung phone. I just don't use that stuff.
Oh, but my wife uses that all the time. She loves it.
Really?
Yeah, she's always swiping with her phone. You know,
like. But it's just insert.
I use it maybe
it's
once or
same.
Twice.
Just insert. But, it's like a.
You know, it's nice when they have it. So you, not every place has installed it mm-hmm. the way it's supposed to be. Because there's some places where you don't have to enter a PIN
or
anything.
It never works. Yeah.
But so she loves that. But yeah, when you have to enter the PIN number anyway, it's almost the same thing, right? But like the Disney store, in Times Square. I remember specifically, she just swiped.
Such a good tourist.
And that was it. That was and she loved that. And then from then on, she just started using it from then on.
And have you done it, John?
I've used it maybe once or twice. Mm-hmm. And then, I'm just too quick with the card.
So no. I used it once out of desperation. I had a flat tire. I needed a new tire. And
not the scenario you would think they, Apple Pay.
I know,
the,
right? No. They repair the tire. And so you're like, great, let me pay. And I had forgotten my wallet. And Apple Pay had just recently come out, and I'd gone along and set it up, and I was like, oh my God, do y'all take Apple Pay? And they did, God bless them. So I was able to pay for it because I thought, there is no way they're going to let me drive off in my car that they just put a tire on if I haven't paid. So that still remains to this day the only time I've tried Apple Pay.
That's very impressive that whoever that was had
it was,
their,
for like a,
it
a
was,
tire
it
shop?
Was,
yeah.
It was a big,
in early days.
It was in early days, but it was a big tire chain.
Okay.
Big chain.
Yeah.
Well, probably got some money to do that. Yeah.
Apparently, you're not alone. They've processed 10 billion transactions thus far, which is an incredible number because again,
over how many years
use it since it was launched? What, 3-4 years
and
ago?
Some percent of that is my wife.
Yeah.
That's right. You've seen her shopping.
She didn't spend all of it at the Disney store in Times Square.
Yeah.
Just a big part of it. Yeah. Yeah. But anyway, I think these two things, both the Apple Pay and the Apple Card, kind of signal a way for Apple to get into the more services part of that and also bring you into that walled garden ecosystem and just, again, cut out all the other players who want to get
It reminds me like the Facebook story, you know. They have one piece. They get everybody in one place. They have advertising. They start putting the authentication. They start putting the product placements. And then pretty soon you're paying through them. It's like one piece of the puzzle at a time. So it kind of makes sense that Apple is putting together the pieces, right? First they start with Apple Pay, they're using other people's cards, they're doing the authentication for you at the beginning with your thumbprint and then now with your face. Soon it'll be with your eyeball. and you know, they're partnering and they have the hardware, and then pretty soon you're getting your loan, you're getting your checking, you're doing everything through them.
Right.
No, thank you.
It's building the bricks one by one towards something, right?
I think that's a holy grail. It's like you're a captured user. You use all their services and you don't give any of your transactional information or a fraction of the cost to any other player.
So the next civil war will be a Facebook versus Apple conflict.
Exciting.
an economic
war. So if you're someone like me who really values privacy, your choice is, okay, let's say I believe Apple, that they're really focused on my privacy and they're going to cut out all these players so my bank and Visa won't know what I spent my money on. But now Apple knows even more about me.
But they don't use that to advertise stuff to you.
They don't. That's true. But what if I just don't want anyone super powerful international company to
like
have
you said, use cash.
Yeah, you use cash. Yeah. Or you do
that's
whatever.
Gonna be the only way.
Yeah, that's untraceable.
Or you have to like distribute little breadcrumbs of your spending with a number of different firms.
Right. So
which is what I do now.
Yeah, I have a friend who practices what he calls signal scrambling, which is where you use multiple browsers on your phone, on your own computer.
Oh my God, I'm your friend.
Yeah.
I
do as well. I use Chrome on my Mac. I use DuckDuckGo on my phone. Mm-hmm. I use Safari sometimes to kind of not give anybody a whole picture of my whole life. I guess that's what you
and
do.
And Steve is actually wearing a tinfoil hat.
It's actually copper. Copper is the way to go.
Copper. Is that reflect better?
And Monica's is bigger.
Yeah.
Monica's always saying that.
Well, when it's true, you can't stop saying it.
If you got it, you got to flaunt it.
Yeah. So this is all focused on the retail side of the world, but there's a lot, maybe even more going on for the small business side as well. There's a lot of money for the small businesses and people are jumping in to make it. So we see that with big companies and smaller ones as well. The Wall Street Journal has a great article that goes over a lot of the use cases and the players for these small and medium-sized business. And we've mentioned that market as being underserved before. There's a lot of potential, but just lack of capital for a lot of these small businesses to expand. So one thing they point out in this article is that it's very convenient. So online financing for a small business is you're more likely to get funding. You're going to get it more quickly, and it's less likely to require collateral. And if you've ever worked at a small business that had to abide by, in the old days, this feels old-fashioned, actually, for me to say loan covenants. And but, you know, it's still very common, of course. But you don't have to keep a certain debt to you know, payments ratio and all these, keep a certain number of assets. None of this is required when you do a loan online through a company like Cabbage or Square Cash or something like that. Actually, and this is a very fast-growing market. According to a Federal Reserve Small Business Credit Survey, a third of small businesses applied for credit last year with an online lender, which was up from 24% in 2017, the prior year, and just exactly because of this convenience. There's three different types that they mentioned. There's the retail payment processors, the peer-to-peer lenders, and the direct lenders like OnDeck and Lending Club. So I like this idea of the retail payment processor side, because it just works in hand with the business. If they're processing your payments like you're using Square, then they just take a percent of your sales, every month or every day, whatever it is. So this guy
paying your lender first.
Paying your lender. Well, they get a percent. So you know, every $100 they get, whatever it works out to be. So they have an example where someone got a $7,800 loan. They have a brewery, and 14.8% of their daily credit card sales goes to paying back the debt. So it kind of works kind of like a partnership, it feels like, right?
So essentially the lender is integrated with their POS system, or their point of sale system, so that they can see the money, the cash flows going into the business, and then take a cut from that, basically.
Yep. It's like Square gave you $7,800, and you're using Square to process your credit card receipts.
It's a pretty brilliant idea, absolutely.
I mean, it just integrates well. You don't have to do anything too much different, or you're not going to have a late payment or something. And as long as you pay it back in a certain amount of time, in this case, they're saying 18 months, then you're not late or you're not extended beyond their terms. And they know your history, so they can say, well, you're probably going to pay it back in 12, You know, so let's say 18, you have to have it in to buy, and they'll adjust the interest accordingly. And that is one of the key issues with these types of online lending is the interest rates. So that $7,800 loan we mentioned, there was a flat fee, which is kind of nice in terms of it being predictable, but it's not cheap. It's $1,008 on $7,800 loan.
That's so a lot of points.
Is that the origination fee? That's extremely high.
It's just a flat fee for the loan.
It is the origination
that
fee.
Is
Square
insane.
Isn't
right.
calling it that, but that's what it
yeah,
is.
$7,800 and you're ending, let's say, in a year at zero. So your average balance is around $4,000. You're paying $1,000 on that average during the year. It's about 25%.
Seems pretty high. Yeah.
Who's right. really good at math here? What's 1 divided by 7 or 1 divided by 8?
So like 14 some, but so that's your balance at the beginning.
Right, so that's the equivalent of paying like 14 points on a loan
right.
instead of what you might see in the mortgage business, which is like 1 point. Now, the
but
numbers
that's the
are-
interest, that's the total that you're paying at the $1,000.
Everything else is just repayment? No, there's
right.
no interest?
Right, so
oh.
it's a flat fee for the loan.
Oh, okay.
So that's why I'm saying the average you know, balance, let's say it's around 4,000, you paid 1,000, so it's around 20 some percent interest. It would work out to be equivalent. And Square Cash is, this is Square Capital in this example. They work with an industrial bank in Utah to actually provide the loan, the back end.
Some web bank or some
regulatory. We've actually talked about this in,
the partnering.
I think, last summer.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. And so that's one of the risks. They have another example. So there's a reputation risk for the lenders that they might get perceived as being predatory and having just exorbitant rates and fees that can, if the loan's large enough, it can break the business and force them into bankruptcy. So they don't want too much of that. Either.
And at the same time, these are typically unsecured loans, which are always going to have a much higher interest rate than when you back a loan with collateral that can be seized by the lender.
Right.
You know, kind of this like 15 to 25% interest rates, like, you know, for somebody who's getting a pretty sizable chunk of money in some cases in like 2 days, you know,
yeah,
I go
right,
online.
Right.
Here's my application. The next day, I have a quick conversation. By the end of the day, I've got the cash.
Yeah, and no, they're not all 15 to 25%, but they can be that high. So you have to be careful. So another lender, it depends on the lender. So PayPal Working Capital gave a loan to somebody for 11% in another case. So you can do some shopping around as well to get a better deal.
So why are borrowers flocking to this when they can have a lower rate if they go with a more traditional lender?
Well, yeah, it's this trade-off. It's this balance between the ease of use and convenience. You can have the loan actually the next day
mm-hmm.
and, have it funded. So, from what the story is saying, it sounds like it makes sense for, like, smaller amounts and for maybe an emergency
yes.
or something broken. So they talk about, like, there's a broken sign. And they that's what they use to advertise their business. They need the cash and fix it up right away.
HVAC or a fridge or something goes down.
Right. Yeah. The sewer backs up or something like that.
Yeah.
And so that makes a lot of sense. It's not a huge amount. They can maybe pay it back quicker, and get around that. So there's that ease versus a little bit of the price you might pay.
Right.
Yeah. The takeaways that I got from this article, where they do give a lot of different examples of small businesses who've taken advantage of these services, is just what John said. If you really need the money fast, and it's not the kind of loan that can ruin your life, you'll probably be all right. Once you start getting into six digits, you probably shouldn't be taking out a $270,000 loan at 17%
that's
interest.
That's maybe worth doing a lot more shopping around.
Yes.
Investing
yes.
a bit more time into getting that, getting the best deal you can. But you might have to work with the bank a little bit and shop around. So, but yeah, it's great that there's another avenue, that there's a lot of money going into you know, improving this kind of situation, making things convenient. And if you're not gambling the money away and putting it back in your business, it's, you know, yeah, like we said, not a terrible idea.
And the owners seem very clear-eyed about that, right? Like, I know I could probably get a better rate somewhere else, but it would have taken so much more time, and I really needed to, you know, replace my water heater or whatever it was.
Sure. Yeah. Right. Yeah, so unless you're just losing money because no one's coming into your cat cafe or something like that.
Yes.
It doesn't sound too bad in most cases, in some cases. But, you know, there's another article that's kind of related to this that I really found interesting, and that's the expansion of fintech. And a lot of them are focusing on small to medium-sized businesses that, again, are well underserved in Latin America as well. There's a great article in finextra.com that goes into how more money is going into fintechs in Latin America. Now, it's nowhere near the size as the U.S. or China.
Nowhere
obviously.
Near. There is a great chart that you should check out.
Yeah, and that goes into the dollar amounts going in, but there are a lot of deals actually happening just for much smaller amounts, which kind of makes sense for a growing area. And again, we mentioned before a few weeks ago, Goldman Sachs was putting money into a small and medium-sized business lender in Mexico that was doing well and growing very quickly.
And we interviewed Jonathan Erbinger a few months ago around this same topic, and his venture fund was also investing in Latin America focused on small businesses.
Right.
Yeah. There are a lot of business opportunities apparently, and the deals and the money are headed in that same direction. They give some great examples in this article. Actually, they mentioned that the total number of fintechs in Latin America is up to 1,100 from 619 just in the past 2 years, which is a 73% increase, which I think says a lot about, you know, how there's a market for the fintech services. Brazil was up 150%, actually, and Mexico, 93% more fintechs. And, you know, those are the largest economies in Latin America. So that makes sense. They're a little bit more developed.
It's interesting because a lot of the players that are in the article here are more in the B2B space, not so much in the B2C space. So there hasn't been a lot of investment into consumer-facing fintech technologies. It's all business.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of growing in both areas. Brazil actually has two fintech unicorns. Actually, they gained two in 2018. And Argentina has a fintech unicorn called Prisma Medios de Pago.
Un unicornio.
Unicornio. I don't think that's how you... That's probably not how you say
it. No,
that.
It is, yeah.
Unicornio?
Unicornio, yeah.
I love that y'all don't know what the word prism is in Spanish, but y'all are arguing about what the word unicorn
which
is.
Which do exist in the... Song of Ice and Fire.
No
universe.
Game of Thrones spoilers.
Yeah, in Game of Thrones. In the books, it's referenced one time, they said.
Okay.
Yeah.
I mean, as
a myth in their world.
Sure.
I might have skipped over that section.
Yeah. Oh, that guy that knows everything, he knows what page it's on.
I'm sure.
So some of the reasons they point out in this Finextra article is that there's more interest now from global tech giants. So Tencent put $180 million into Nubank. That's helping get those 5 million customers also. And Visa is also backing several accelerator programs in Brazil and in Mexico. Again, our two big markets. But I guess one of the downsides is if all these big players, and we'll bring Amazon, the hyper competitor to everybody in the world, coming into your market, you know, that's more competition. You got to grow quickly before all these big players come in. So Amazon's offering a credit card, or I should say a debit card, which is more popular in Mexico. And of course, it goes without saying, Amazon is planning to expand in this market. All right, now it's time for our final bite, where we look at a number and the fascinating story behind it. Or at least the way Steve tells the story, it is fascinating.
Oh, can I go first?
What's your final bite?
Yeah, so my final bite is 10,000, which is the number of city workers in Baltimore that have been locked out of their workstations.
And they're more productive than ever. I hope that affects the parking ticket people as well.
I think the meter maids have like computers.
I didn't want to say meter maid because there can be men.
Sure. I feel like it's parking very easy to be flip about this, but this is a terrible thing.
It is a and terrible number.
I hope that these hackers are caught and punished very severely.
And brought to justice. Yeah,
because where does it stop?
It's such a shitty thing to do, right? Yeah. Shut down a whole city for money.
Think about what cities support. You know, you think this won't happen to your local utility? You're wrong. You think this won't happen to, what does this do for your 911 dispatchers? What, I mean, these are real serious issues, and state and cities already, and the federal government, probably are already deeply underinvested in technology anyway.
We should specify
cybersecurity, especially, yeah.
Right, right. We should actually explain that this is a number of people who have been affected by a ransomware attack. So hackers hacked into the Baltimore City cyber system, and they're requesting 13 bitcoins to release the or to free rather their computer network, which is seems like it's only 100K actually. It's not too much money, but again, they can bring a whole, you know, a medium-sized city to its knees.
It's such a Bond villain kind of thing to do, right?
It's
I'm going to shut down your city unless you pay $100,000. I was like, what?
Why are we picking on Baltimore? Baltimore has a rough time.
They do.
Hey, hackers, please let Baltimore have a free pass.
Great music scene. But anyway, that's my number. Quite depressing.
If anything on The Wire was true, then please leave Baltimore alone.
But the waterfront and crabs and the Orioles and all that stuff is so good.
Yeah.
That's true. The crab cakes are very good.
They're quite delicious.
And the people are very friendly.
Wait, what does that have to do with The Wire?
It's set in
it's
Baltimore.
Set in The Wire.
No, that's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
Leave them alone.
I'm just being a Baltimore booster.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
We all need a lift sometimes. But if you came to my final bite for good news, you won't find it either. The Wall Street Journal recently reported that 8.1% of credit card balances held by folks in the U.S. between 18 to 29 years of age, they're delinquent by 90 days or more in the first quarter of this year. So what that means is we're creeping up on some of the youngest people who have credit cards in this country. About nearly 10% of them are 3 months behind on their credit card bills.
At least they don't have student loans or anything like that.
Oh, man.
Well, not those Morehouse graduates. They got a free pass.
The Morehouse graduates did get a free pass. This is the highest share that this number has represented since the first quarter of 2011. And if you want to cast your mind back to the first quarter of 2011, those were dark days for the economy.
So is this a leading indicator for what's coming down the pike? Is there going to be an implosion in credit card debt, or an explosion, rather, in credit card debt?
I mean, I certainly don't know, but one of the things that I think a lot about is some of the people, the youngest adults in this country who are setting themselves up for hopefully, you know, fine and happy futures. They are facing an economic and debt credit environment that we just really do not know what that looks like, what kind of trajectory this has. And I feel for folks, and I want them to be able to pay their bills and then maybe cut up their credit cards if it doesn't work for you.
Just use Apple Pay.
It's affecting, you know, it affects their birth rate, it affects their homeownership rate,
it affects their retirement rate, it affects their marriage rate, it affects all of the things that you mentioned. And we really don't have any idea what this experiment looks like, and we're gonna find out.
I just learned recently that apparently in the U.S., if you subtract immigration, we actually have a very low birth rate.
Oh, yeah.
Like, on par with, like, Italy and Japan.
Is it negative without immigration?
It's negative.
It might be negative.
Yeah. It's the same as most EU countries and Japan, which has a famously low birth rate. Fascinating.
Well, yeah. Their population's already decreasing, right?
Right.
All right, so on to the other good news.
John, what you got for us?
Cheer me up, John. Cheer me up.
There are other things destroying the world already. Okay, well, my final bite is nothing like the end of the world you guys are talking about. So we have distributed applications, which are great. They come out of Ethereum and Bitcoin and all the other cryptocurrencies. And it's great because they're decentralized applications and decentralized exchanges, which don't let anybody control everything. And it's this utopian future where we're all in this together and there's great security, no problems, right? Except one little thing. they're not so decentralized after all. My final byte is 376, which is the number of wallets that control 1/3 of all Ethereum. So if you are worried about poor income distribution in the real world, well, it's much worse in the crypto world. And this is important because if you have this very concentrated amount of ownership in any cryptocurrency, well, you're not very decentralized, are you? And you're subject to manipulation, price movements, and collusion to even change the code if you control just a relatively small amount of wallets. So there are a few large multi-millionaires out there, I guess, even at the current Ethereum prices, that can shake things up. So you don't have that decentralization that's been promised to everybody.
And so, if it's 376 wallets, it could conceivably certainly be the case that there are people who have more than one of these particular wallets.
Right.
So it could be even a smaller number of actual people.
That's wallets, right, not exactly ownership. So it could only be less, right? And if you think, well, fine, screw Ethereum, Bitcoin is still out there. Well, actually, there's 448 people that own 20% of Bitcoin.
Wait, people or wallets?
They say people.
People. So yeah. Ethereum is wallets, Bitcoin is people.
And corporations are people, so who knows? So they can also, you can also manipulate Bitcoin. And I'm sure it's worse with some of the smaller ones where the founders or the beginning people own a pretty good chunk of that cryptocurrency.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're counting on that decentralized utopian future where nobody can manipulate and nobody can take advantage of the rules,
hodl on tight.
Well, yeah, be careful. Especially take a look if you're interested in some of the smaller Bitcoins, some of the smaller cryptocurrencies. How concentrated is that ownership? And that's going to give you some indication of how secure and how subject to manipulation and changing of the rules that you might be subject to. It's another risk.
I have a question. Where are we getting these wallet counts?
Ah, right. This is very transparent, actually. There's a company. This came out in Ethereum World News, and there's a research company called Chainalysis, Inc., which is very good. I mean, if you think you're anonymous on a cryptocurrency, pray that someone you don't want to know about that doesn't go to Chainalysis. They can tell everything.
Every transaction, of course, every transaction, but also with the ownership.
They can trace back just about everything. And there's stories about them being able to track back ownership and, you know, going back to the beginning of Bitcoin even.
Wow.
So they're very good at what they do. So
if
they say, yeah, we should talk to them. If they say there's 376 wallets, I pretty much trust Chainalysis, that they're spot on. And, you know, that can probably change a little bit here and there. So, yeah, it kind of questions the smart contract effectiveness and the whole purpose of decentralized platforms when there's concentration, actually.
It almost makes you want a Facebook coin. Almost.
Yeah, that won't have that problem.
Or a Twitter coin, yeah.
Yeah, I'm waiting for the Apple coin.
Yeah.
So. Actually, Apple has all my coins. The way they price things.
Stop buying iPhones.
John has an excess.
All right, that's it for this episode of the FinTech Newscast. Please hit subscribe to keep up with the latest in FinTech news. And thank you for listening.
Thanks so much.
Bye for now.